Hi, this is Susie Larson, and thank you so much for listening to Live the Promise today. Our website is filled with even more powerful and encouraging interviews. Learn more by logging on to myfaithradio.com. Good afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise, and we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. Welcome. So glad you tuned in. Happy Monday. Hope you had a great weekend. Well, I have a question for you at the outset. Are you ready? Well, actually, it's a few questions. Do you ever feel like you're missing it, that there's something deeper and more exciting to be discovered in this faith journey? You know, sometimes we fall into a rut and we forget that Jesus died to bring us abundant life in every sense of the word. So we're going to talk about how to embrace your God-given humanity and to live the life Jesus paid such a high price for. Isn't that what you long for? What do you dream about? What do you hunger after? I'm talking to you today, and I've got such a special guest and such an amazing book to talk about first hour. You're going to want to get the phone number on speed dial, because I'm pretty much sure that everybody who calls in will get a copy. Well, at least the first 10 of you. 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. In the second hour, Bill and Pam Farrell join us. They join us every month to talk about different aspects of parenting and marriage and family. Today, we're going to talk about some of the best decisions you can make as a parent. All right, so get ready. So this is what my first hour guest, Matt Hurd, writes. Regardless of the day or the dilemma, we each have an opportunity to embrace something, not only the fact that our hearts are beating, but why they're beating. In the midst of Monday morning realities, Jesus can breathe life into our life. I can't wait for you to meet Matt. I can't wait to get him on. Quick announcement, the great giveaway is underway. And if you're wondering what I'm talking about, get to our website, myfaithradio.com. But basically, here on Live the Promise, we've done this every year for a number of years. We want to mobilize an army to get outside your comfort zone and commit a purposeful random act of kindness for somebody that can't pay you back. I'm sending you on a mini mission trip, and then on December 18th, which happens to be my birthday, you're going to call back and you're going to tell us your stories. And I'm telling you, we hear from listeners who say they have to actually pull over because they're crying, because they're so inspired by your stories. So on your mark, get set, go. Now, this is the new twist this year. Get to our website and you fill out the little form that says basically count me in. And this little twist is so fun. When you do that, you're going to get a Faith Radio mug filled with a bunch of goodies, and then you're going to get a beautiful card to go with your gift. So the recipient knows why they're getting this gift from you, because God loved you so much that he gave that you're giving. And so as part of the great giveaway, you're giving them a wonderful gift. So go to our website, myfaithradio.com. The two best stories on December 18th win a great gift basket full of goodies. One of the goodies in the basket is Matt Hurd's book, Life with a Capital L, Embracing Your God-Given Humanity. So I don't want to waste another moment. Let me tell you about him. We'll get him on the show. Matt Hurd was the senior pastor at Woodman Valley Chapel for 12 years. He and his wife, Arlene, live in Colorado Springs and are the privileged parents of three adult sons. Whether standing in front of people with a microphone or in a trout stream with a fly rod, whether sitting around a dinner table with friends or serving a need in his city, Matt loves exploring and experiencing life with a capital L. You can find his influencer page at our website, myfaithradio.com. Matt, great to meet you. Great to have you on the show.
Susie, it's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. You've written a fabulous book. I'm excited to dig into the content. But we have this thing we do every day on Live the Promise. We start out our conversations talking scripture. We love the word of God. And you chose John 10:10. The thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. But I come that you may have life and life to the full. Talk about why you chose that passage.
Yeah, it's a verse that's familiar to a lot of people that have been hanging around church, but sometimes I think it's too familiar because it is central to why Jesus came. I mean, even fast forwarding to the disciples, why they gave their lives. They ended up giving their physical lives for the gospel, and it was not because Jesus had a new cool set of rules that he wanted to give everybody, not because he had a new religious system or ideology. It was because he gave them life. I mean, Peter said himself, where else am I going to go? When several people were abandoning Jesus, and he said, do you also want to leave? And Peter says, no, where else are we going to find the words of this life? Mm-hmm. And John, at the end of his gospel, where John 10:10 is included, at the end of it, in John 20:31, Peter says, I've written these things so that you may really get it right about Jesus, but in doing so, that the result would be that you would have life in his name. And I think that verse is central to why Jesus came, not to give us some super spiritual existence, but to give us life, what I refer to as life with a capital L. A little lowercase life is my heart beating, my lungs breathing, but this life with a capital L is restoring me back into the original purpose that God made me for.
And that is such a beautiful way to unpack it, Matt, because when you think about it, we all are in some ways products of our experiences. I mean, you think about it, we have tangled up fears and insecurities. We have sort of hot buttons that if someone pushes, they may get a reaction out of us. And I think all those places are places Jesus can go and untangle and redeem, where once we had brokenness, we can have fruitfulness and wholeness. I mean, it's possible, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's possible not just in an isolated spiritual compartment. I mean, you're talking about untangling. None of those things that you just mentioned are stuff that I've ever struggled with in Sunday school class. They're what I struggle with when the alarm clock rings on a Monday morning, and you know, in that meeting with clients, or in that trip to the hospital, or that vacation that we spent a lot of money on that seems to not be delivering what we were hoping for. That's where those are the kind of things that need to be untangled. The betrayals, the hurt, and the accumulated pain. And so, but I think so often, as we've talked about John 10:10 over the years in a lot of circles, have you ever heard people, Susie, say, talk about the abundant Christian life?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're revealing a bias that's not biblical. It's like a Gnosticism or dualism, and those are words from way out there. But bottom line, back in the early church, there were people saying, hey, material stuff is bad, spiritual is good, let's put the material aside, which for many people includes their humanity. So my humanity must be a bad thing. I've got to become more spiritual in order to become less human and therefore be more pleasing to God and escape from all of this pain. But Jesus is saying, he doesn't say, I've come that you might have an abundant Christian life or spiritual life. He's saying, I've come that you might have an abundant life, a life to the full. It's not different. It's different from what we've been experiencing, but it's not different from what he intended.
And this is what we're going to spend this hour unpacking, because if we can have the best of intentions, but really are kind of misunderstanding what God intended, we will miss the fullness of what he meant, you know?
Absolutely.
I was a fitness instructor for a lot of years, and I remember, you know, seeing different people on TV doing a push-up going, work those biceps. And I'm like, I know you mean to work your biceps, but you're not going to work them if you're doing a push-up, you know? And I think so often we kind of do that same thing, as if we're pleasing God if we sabotage our dreams and our joys and our hopes, as if that is a virtue somehow. And yet I'm trying to imagine my own child doing that. Would that please my heart? It wouldn't. But we misunderstood what's pleasing to him. We find ourselves on a road that's different from what he intends, don't we?
Absolutely. I mean, the core of the gospel, the good news of the gospel, is yes, it's be forgiven of your sins and you get to go to heaven, but it is so much more. It is in order that for us, our humanity, what God created in the first place and called good, he's not saying, hey, that didn't work, let's go with plan B. He came back to redeem. Christ came to restore what he had made and had been good.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you open the book Life with a Capital L with a beautiful description of this painting by a Russian artist. And tell us about the painting, but first of all, then it kind of explain how it just sort of stopped you in your tracks and even confronted your own life.
Oh, yeah. So we're involved with a Russian orphanage that we partnered with and sponsored. And so I was over there with two other close friends, and we had taken a day off to go through the Tretyatov State Gallery there in Moscow. And I got behind them, and I'm rushing through the museum trying to catch up with them. And I passed through this room, and over to my right, a painting caught my eye. Why it caught my eye, I guess we now know, because it became a seedbed for even this book, and really a hinge point for me to enter into this whole dialogue about life with a capital L. But I looked over, and it just caught my eye, so I stopped. And it is it was painted in 1888 by Nikolai Yeroshenko, and back during some really difficult days in Russia's history. People were starting to be sent to Siberia, to prison camps, and it was a prison rail car And so these, you've got five people, a peasant, a soldier, a farmer, a mother, and a child. And the four adults are kind of gathered around this child. They're all with their faces pressed against the bars of this prison rail car. And it's stopped at a platform, a railway platform, in a very hopeless trajectory, a one-way trip probably, to Siberia. I mean, the essence of something, really of what fallen humanity is all about. They're experiencing the fall and the hopelessness. But in the midst of that, there's paused, and this child is feeding some birds on the railway platform. And the contrast caught me. It drew me over to see who painted it. And I'd heard of the painter, but I'd not heard of this particular painting. And I looked at the title. And on the little plaque beside the painting was, "There is life everywhere." Mm. And I was so intrigued. I don't know what people did before, I put my smartphone to work right then, and I sat down on the only bench in the room and started Googling Nikolai Yurashenko and this painting. And I discovered that 3 years before, Leo Tolstoy, whom we've all heard of, wrote a short story called What Men Live By, and Yurashenko says it's that short story that inspired him to do this painting. So I looked up the short story. At the beginning of Tolstoy's story, he has 1 John 3:14, and again, John's Gospel, the Epistles of John, written by the same guy, big theme of life in them, and 1 John 3:14 refers to how when we love our brothers, it's an indication that we've moved from death to life. Meaning, it's these two categories that Jesus was constantly talking about. You know, John 5:24, when you trust me, you're going to be transferred. The moment you believe, you're moved from this realm of death to this realm of life. And I say all of that to say, okay, immediately I knew what kind of life Yurashenko was referring to. When he says there is life everywhere, he's not talking about, hey, there's this positive outlook that we can take in the midst of any circumstance. I mean, that might be true, but what he's referring to is this life of Jesus, the life that Christ restores us into in the midst of a fallen world. And I just sat down and stared because I thought, is he asking a question or is he making a statement to say there's life everywhere? And if you're looking at the painting and inside the book, you'll start seeing something I missed until I was staring at it for a moment. There's a sixth guy. He's on the other side of the rail car, looking out the other window. You could just see his silhouette. And it struck me, he's missing the life that's everywhere. And then it hit me, Susie. I thought, I am. I'm missing it. That's me. Hmm. I'm rushing through not just through a museum. I'm rushing through my life. I was distracted by, you know, we've always got physical issues, maybe some health issues, a couple of relational conflicts, uncertainty about a decision at work. And there's all of this stuff that I've been letting distract me from the life of Christ that is everywhere, no matter what my circumstance.
Oh, it's so good. I wish you guys could see this painting, and it's in the front cover of his book. But these people with their faces pressed up to the bars that are holding them in, but at the window to the outside, and this little girl dropping little seedlings for these birds, and she's smiling, and they're sort of taken by her. You know, as you're talking, Matt, it reminds me of that Elizabeth Barrett Browning quote, and it goes like this. I'm sure you've heard of it. Earth is crammed with heaven, every common bush afire with God. Only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest just sit around and pluck blackberries. And I think that's so amazing when you think about it, that he who sees takes off his shoes. And I want so much for this season that we're entering into to be that kind of take off your shoes kind of season, because God is in our midst. And one more story came to me, Matt, as I was listening to you talk, is I don't remember at what point in Joseph of the Old Testament story, but he was in prison and he had every reason to be bitter, but that there was a point where he asks his fellow prisoners, why the long face? And that's my paraphrase, but he did ask him, like, what's the matter? Why the long face? And I'm like, why not the long face? And to be in a position where he could be an encourager and to notice the contrast that their countenance was gloomy, but his wasn't. That's a stewardship. I would say a daily stewardship, especially in hard times, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, and what's ironic, it's so interesting that you bring that up, because the last week, that was a big theme just in terms of my own scripture and feeding time before God is the story of Joseph. And it's so amazing how often the phrase appears, and the Lord of God, and the Lord was with him, mm-hmm. the Lord was with Joseph. And it's saying that as he's hauled off to prison, and the Lord was with Joseph. And I think, I know for me, I get hauled off to prison, especially unjustly like that, and I've been framed and all the other stuff that's going on in Joseph's life. You wondered, now, is the Lord really with me? Hmm. But, I mean, that's the gospel. I mean, what does Jesus say in back to the Gospel of John? He says, in this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I've overcome the world. So often we're wanting him to take us out of the trouble, and he says, no, the deal is you're in the same fallen world. The moment you trust Christ, you're in the same fallen world you were beforehand, but the difference now is I'm with you, and there is life everywhere that you can now begin to experience.
And that's the word, the life everywhere, and you think about that because, you know, Joseph really was more fruitful as a prisoner and a slave than his brothers were as free men. And so when we determine life that it's, you know, everything goes our way, we're missing it. But when we understand there was a favor on him, so he marked every place that he went to in a way where people, he left the place better than he found it. And so there's a deeper lesson there for us, isn't there?
Yeah, it's this. We spend so much energy trying to manipulate and control our circumstances. And, you know, of course, we don't want to be masochists. We don't want to say, hey, let's make it more miserable and in order to be happy. We don't do that. But there's a limit to what we can control in our lives. But the beauty is, even in the midst of the brokenness, there is beauty. Because God says, I come to you in the midst of a fallen world. And Psalm 23, we talk about walking through the valley of the shadow of death. And I think we think that's only in a season where we're encountering the physical death of someone close to us. Yet that psalm is a 24/7 psalm.
Yeah.
We are constantly in our lives journeying through the valley of the shadow of death, not around. There's no exemption card that comes with the gospel that says, okay, now everything's going to be fine and you won't have difficulty again. He says, in this world, you'll have trouble. That the good news is taking heart because I'm victor. I've overcome.
And so you will overcome. Here's a quote from your book. Are we just playing little games or are we realizing life while we live it? Are we engaging our full humanity? It's one thing to wake up and realize you've been asleep, but it's another to wake up and actually start living. Unpack that more for us.
Yeah. There is really a twofold application. Maybe someone listening right now is not yet a follower of Christ, and they're debating, okay, what's the validity of the gospel? Is it for me? And it's applying to them, but it's also applying to the person who has trusted Christ and has been made alive but is not experiencing life. I mean, Scripture says if I'm not yet a follower of Christ, I'm spiritually dead. I mean, I'm breathing, I'm doing life, I'm still in the image of God, I can laugh, I can cry, I can play, but there's something muted, and the gospel is a summons for us to come alive. But once I've come alive, it is still a daily decision as to whether I'm going to experience that life or not. And the life is everywhere, but will I experience it?
And to understand what the life is, what this capital L is, I mean, I think this is the whole purpose of your book, and I know it's an eye-opener. It will be an eye-opener for many because we so often emphasize one thing at the expense of another, and I'm going to unpack that. I'm going to have you unpack that in a moment, but this quote from your book jumped off the page at me, and I want you to unpack this one for us first. It says, Christ came to save us from our empty rebelliousness, not from our humanity. Explain that.
Yeah, we that it goes back to, I flew by it a minute ago, but that I think there's some dualism that enters into our journey, meaning we separate the physical and the spiritual, and the spiritual being obvious, our walk with God, but the physical being all of those aspects of our lives that are very real to us, from our vocation to recreation to, you know, the our emotional lives to what we do in our culture, how we care for our culture, our material possessions, all of that is physical. And I think so often we think, if I can just get away from that, all that physical stuff, and submerge myself in the spiritual, everything's going to feel better. Well, that's a dualism that was never intended in the gospel. I mean, our humanity is not something that Christ is trying to save us from. He's saving us from the rebelliousness that's embedded in our humanity. But my humanity in and of itself is not sinful. Dying to self, which is a biblical concept, does not mean dying to my humanity. Being worldly is something I'm to avoid, yes, but that is not the same thing. Being worldly is not the same thing as being human. And so often I think we get this notion that Christ came to save me from my humanity, and that's the message that the culture is hearing from us. Surprisingly, they're saying, no, thank you.
Yeah.
When Jesus did not, that's not what he was saying. Who are the people that were spending the most time with him and so intrigued by him? It was not the religious crowd, those that were trying to say, if I can reach this spiritual state, everything will be great. It was the people that were trying to do real life. And seeing the connection between those two, basically my spiritual life is not to be an escape from the physical, but it's to enhance my experience of all the physical stuff in my journey, my relationships, my vocation, my recreation, my vacations, my grieving, my laughing. I mean, the more spiritual healthy I become in my spirituality, the more healthy I should become in my humanity, because that's why he came, to restore us to the original gift of being human that he created in the first place.
You know, Matt, we tend to develop a reactionary theology without even realizing it. And you think about how people, you know, the culture has made such an idol of the body, so we just think total neglect is more godly than caring for our body. And again, I told you before the show, fitness is in my background, but I, as a fitness person, I got so deathly sick, I was crawling through life. So once I was able to get back on a bike and ride fast and ride a long distance, it was worship to me. And I would hear those little voices, you know, saying, you know, but the culture has made an idol out of health. And I'm like, but I'm not, because this is, I've put a flag in the ground. I get to ride my bike again. And I feel so close to God when I do. But you sure can see that mindset where we develop this reactionary theology because of the excesses of the earth. But that puts us into a different kind of imbalance, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if I'm going to operate according to that philosophy, sooner or later, I'm going to have to do away with church volunteerism, because that becomes an idol in people's lives. You know, there's the sinful, overtly sinful stuff. Certainly, I've got to turn from that. But because of the longings that are resounding deep within me, and me trying to pursue things that will address those longings, yes, I turn to sinful stuff, but I also turn to things that are quite healthy, such as caring for my body, or marriage, or vocation. And so if I've got my spiritual life and walk with Christ beginning to help me with my humanity, all of a sudden I'm rescued from, say, workaholism, where I'm trying to extract from work what it's not going to be able to ultimately provide for me, or extract from my physical health what it's not going to be able to offer me, and even, let's say, marriage. You know, how many times do we try to put our spouse up to fulfilling expectations that only God is going to be able to fulfill for us? And so that mantra that you're talking about, you're right, it's widespread. But if you're going to be consistent to say, oh, wait a minute, our culture has taken the human body and physical health too much, therefore we need to ignore our physical health, we've got to take that across the board and avoid anything that's capable of becoming an idol. Well, if that's the case, the list is long, and it's a lot of things that many of us are exposed to that we see. I mean, I think you and I both have seen people that they would never think of their involvement in church as being an idol, but it has become that. They're trying to extract from their volunteerism what only God's going to provide.
And boy, you make such a good point, because if we deny that and we compartmentalize, we're still going to be drawing then from a wrong source versus wrapping our arms around it, having it be an offering, letting God get to speak to us about our little imbalances. I mean, I think it's such a beautiful journey when you think about, God, you have access to my story, and all of life was meant to be lived you know, yeah. in your presence. Love that. Talking to Matt Hurd, he's got a fabulous book out titled Life with a Capital L. I know we've been very engaged in conversation. I want to give him as much time as possible, but I do want to get a copy in your hands. If you've got a question or a comment you want to chime in, now is the time to do it. 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484, or Susie at myfaithradio.com. Shoot me an email. Back with Matt Hurd in a moment. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. Having a great conversation with Matt Hurd. His new book is titled Life with a Capital L, Embracing Your God-Given Humanity. He's endorsed by all of our favorites, Mark Batterson, John Ortberg, Johnny Erickson, Tada, Jenny Allen, Lee Strobel, all these guys, Jim Daly, have all been on the show before. It's a fabulous book, and we're talking about that Jesus didn't come to set us free from our humanity, but from our rebellious sinfulness. And in the book, Matt, you tell these stories of folks who maybe emphasized one area of their lives at the expense of another. For instance, Carl pursued the physical without the spiritual, so he was making all kinds of money until his son had a word to say to him. Can you remember that story? Would you mind sharing that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's where so often we get out of balance in terms of our pursuit of our humanity, and the overall umbrella is some people pursue physical, neglecting the spiritual, others pursue spiritual stuff, neglecting the physical, and it's trying to combine the two, but to do so under the tutelage of the gospel. But going back to Carl, what you're saying is, okay, so Carl's trying to, you know, we've all got this compass in us that wants to be fully human. And we're figuring out what's best going to fulfill us. And Carl picked, you know, the physical realm includes so much. But one of those is financial, material. And material possessions are not bad. When they become idols, that's when it gets in trouble. But Carl, he wasn't a follower of Christ, incredibly successful guy. I knew of at least five different companies that he had bought and sold, and you know, he had his homes all over, you know, in the mountains and at the beach, and he thought he was doing pretty good, until he had what he refers to as it was just the conversation. It was a jolt for him with his adult son, who had lived with this man, watched him, now gone off, and the adult son was really beginning to grasp what it means to walk with God and have a relationship with God through Christ. He comes back to his dad, and he said point blank to him, he said, you know, you figured out how to build a lot of companies, but I'm not sure you've ever figured out how to love. And it just stopped Carl in his tracks. It sent him down a pursuit of, maybe I don't have this all figured out. And that notion of not being able to love, sooner or later, if you look at that, loved people are able to love people. And he started realizing he first needed to grasp the love of God in order to give it away. And that started bringing him back into a more of a full embrace of his humanity. He didn't leave his company and move to a cave in the mountains. He continued to lead companies and lead well, but he became a kingdom player.
Wow.
And he started realizing, you know what, I was way out of balance. And so his humanity had been out of kilter because he was emphasizing the physical over the spiritual.
And that's the thing you started to say before the break. We almost default and go there when we're not really gleaning our life from Christ himself. I mean, we might try to compartmentalize our life, but by just doing that, we set up a scenario for idols. And this one was so interesting to me. It was a friend of yours named Wayne. And just because of the way that he was raised to really believe that the physical is just, it can't be spiritual, he emphasized the spiritual without the physical. So talk about just his core belief and how he came upon the realization of what God really intended for him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We were talking through some of this whole notion of is my humanity bad? And to say, I mean, my humanity is fallen. All of ours is. But that's not to mean to say it's evil any more than is creation fallen? Yes, but it's not evil in and of itself. God says, I've made it, and he said, I made humanity, and it's good. In fact, Jesus came as fully human, and he wouldn't have become fully human if humanity is bad. So we're talking about that, and he just laid the cards out. He said, you know, I grew up in a real legalistic home, and, you know, he said, my parents loved me, and but at the same time, I started getting this notion that the most important thing for me was doing my devotions, and really nothing else mattered during my day. And he started thinking that if I'm going to be passionate about anything, it's going to be sinful. And the whole notion of moderation came up, and he started realizing that if he could spend as much of his time in this spiritual state as possible, maybe God would love him more. Mm. And he says, I finally started realizing that I thought that Christianity and my relationship with Jesus was meant to get me away from my humanity. And, I mean, I'm listening to him, Susie, and I'm just grieved that, bottom line, he was dehumanizing himself. He was saying this is bad, what God had said is good. And that's different from saying this is fallen. I can say humanity is fallen. That's not what I'm talking about. He was saying that I've got to get away from my humanity in order to get closer to God. And that's not the gospel.
And if you believe that, and I'm sorry, that message really is communicated in so many ways. But if you kind of unpack it and unlayer it, you know, underneath it all, it makes God sound like a cosmic killjoy slave driver, and everything about our faith journey is an ought to and a should do. You ought to pray, you should do, you ought to. And I always say on this show, when those things become ought tos, those good things become ought tos and should dos and not get tos, I've lost sight of the love of God, because it's all a get to when it's in response to the fact that he loved me first. And for me, that's just how I've had to live it out. But how sad when you think of somebody living under that heavy blanket going, any dream I might have, hunger, passion, it's disconnected from my faith. And so, you know what I'm saying, where they're slugging along, and where's the joy and where's the passion? That's a sad commentary if that's what we've been communicating, but I do believe many have heard that.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, even what you just said about people thinking the dreams, I can't go down the path of my dreams or pay attention to my longings. How sad that we have picked up on that. And one of the things that I talk about in the book, that I actually have been, you know, chewing on this for several years, but I believe it more now than ever. And I make the statement, it's always dangerous to try to quote yourself from a book because then people can check you out.
I dare
you. But it's going to sound similar to this. But if a superficial and therefore short-circuited embrace of my longings is going to lead me to a superficial embrace of the gospel and in a short-circuited experience of the gospel. And the same crowd who says my humanity is bad often will say those longings, you know, those are bad too. And so my longings are not bad. What I do with them can be bad, but I'm talking about the core longings for significance, for security, for truth, for beauty, for love, for intimacy. Those are things that God has placed in me. It's the Ecclesiastes 3 eternity that's in my heart. And so often we squelch those. We put those to the side and say, well, I can't pay attention to those. I need to seek Jesus. But what did he do with the woman by the well? Mm-hmm. He exposed gently. He didn't judge her. He did not shame her. And in that moment, when he talks about her husbands and having five husbands and the guy she's living with now not being her husband, a lot of the legalistic crowd will say, oh, yeah, there you go, Jesus, good job. You're letting her know she's been. No, he was exposing for her had been her ultimate idol, and saying, that's not going to quench your soul thirst, and you need to come to me. And but she had been going to men for those deepest longings, just as some of us might go to careers or drugs or addictions or church involvement. We're thinking, this is where I'm going to get my ultimate significance from. And this is where I'm going to get my ultimate security. If I get a bank account with this amount of money in it, I'll be secure. Well, guess what? When we get that amount, something else comes up and we say just a little bit more. It's never there. It's the proverbial ox in front of a carrot in front of the ox cart, and it doesn't work.
And it really does beg us to look at the why behind what we're doing, because if we hyper-spiritualize our lives and our faith journey to really mean, you know, I always say that the narrow path isn't the same as a narrow mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
the narrow
yeah.
path is Jesus plus nothing is everything. But to spiritualize it to say only people who are in ministry, they're almost a different class of Christians, is heartbreaking to me, because you know what? The world needs doctors and bankers and tellers and cleaners. And when you start to think about, if you have a particular interest, you know, my husband's a commercial construction manager, and I always tell him, you're like a Boaz, because he's this strong guy on this really rough industry, and he's a man of integrity, and I know God has commissioned him to be there, and that's his own ministry. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like he carries the kingdom with him. I just believe that. And so to broaden our perspective that God does care about where you work, and if you have an interest in brain surgery, maybe God put it there. And so just speak to the idea even of how we've hyper-spiritualized Christian service. It matters.
Yeah.
Ministry matters. You hear me, but you know what I'm
Absolutely.
Saying.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, you're hitting the nail on the head, because that's, and sorry to bring up a word that none of us have used it since lunch, dualism. You know, I know we used it this morning a lot, but maybe not since lunch. Are you kidding? And I'm not meaning to throw a curveball in to use a word that we've never heard, but it's that saying, the material physical is bad, the spiritual God is good, and God's not in the material. That's what you're referring to when it comes to vocation. I mean, I can't tell you how many guys that are running multi-million dollar companies. Over the years, I've talked to, and a few have bared their soul and said, you know what, I'm really successful, but my parents are still upset with me for not going into full-time ministry.
Mm.
And it's something about, okay, the ministry, because it's spiritual, is supposedly good, and everything else is bad. Well, let's carry that out. If that's true, then everybody should be in full-time ministry. And I'm telling you what, if that's the case, I'm not going out to eat at any restaurant
exactly.
because it's going to be pathetic. You know,
yes.
I'm not going to buy a car because it's not going to run. All of those things can be full-time ministry. I prefer to refer to it as vocational ministry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when were Adam and Eve before the fall not spiritual? You know, they were spiritual when they were tending the garden and doing that was their career and their vocation. They were spiritual when they were loving each other, when they were exalting in a sunset. It was all a spiritual experience, which I think is some of, actually I know it's what's behind when Paul says, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, whatever you do it all for the glory of God. And experience his smile in the spiritual ramifications of what we're doing all the time, not just when we're in church and in devotions.
Okay, and let's switch gears then and look at the spiritual service, how sometimes it looks so spiritual, but as you say, it's coming out of a place of idolatry in that we're looking for either approval, favor with the leadership, identity, you know, qualifiers, and those kinds of things. And none of us are doing this perfectly, and oftentimes we're coming initially with a
Sure.
sincere heart. But I often, when I speak at women's conferences, I always challenge women and say, you know, sometimes church committees are filled with women who are hiding from God because he wants to put his finger on something in your life, and you're like, no, I'll just join another committee and get extra busy because I don't want to have this conversation. But truly to spend some of our time in his presence so he can heal and reveal and correct and redirect. So talk about just how a person knows if they're serving. What are maybe some of the symptoms if they're serving out of a place that isn't necessarily an invitation from God?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you hit on a couple of them. I mean, if the self-worth issue, okay, I'm going to feel better about myself. Let me tell you, the fact that the King of the universe has come to me, clothed himself in human flesh, and given his life, and he has said, I've done this because you are worth my love, because I love you. And the fact that I have given you my approval, there is nothing you can do in any arena of your life that's going to get me to love you more than I do right now. But so often we don't believe that. We do not believe the gospel. So we think, if I do this particular activity, it'll get God to like me more. And, you know, we miss the difference between God's favor and pleasing him, because his favor can't be earned. It's not deserved. He gives it to us in grace, and then we learn to please him. But we're not pleasing him in order to get him to love us. So self-worth, the issue of sometimes people will do it for security. I've talked to people, I know you have, that say they're in a hospital, have had a tragic accident, or maybe they're in the twilight years of their journey, and death seems near, and they're saying, boy, I'm sure glad that I served in the church as much as I did, because I've got that to fall back on. Mm. And thinking, that does not earn me anything. It's Christ that earns me that favor and places me in this stead. And we're behaving like orphans so often, where we're saying, oh, if I can only get the smile of this begrudging God, maybe if I take an extra Sunday school class instead of just the one I'm already teaching, maybe he'll like me a little bit more. You got to excuse me, I'm from the South, so I'll say, am I scratching where you're itching?
That's what they asked me down there. Absolutely. So, and I have so many more pages of questions. You're going to have to come back next month if you're able, because so many more questions. But this feels important to me, Matt. I just am maybe sensing somebody's listening and that we need to go down this road a little bit. So I'm thinking one of the symptoms when we are serving at church, maybe for the wrong reasons, even though we're well-intentioned, are how do you respond if you don't get the thank you, if you don't get noticed or you get repositioned? Because I've met people as I've traveled around that have gotten such an offense with church leadership and even with God because they felt like they had real estate on that position. And when they were moved out of it, they turned their hearts away from the Lord. And to me, it's like sometimes God just loves you so much that he allows you to lose that position so you can find your worth in him, because it's a false security, even in the context of church service, where he doesn't want us drinking from any cracked cistern, even if it looks spiritual, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Jeremiah 2 passage you're talking about, where he says, He's saying, my people, this is not just somebody, my people have committed two sins. Number one, they've forsaken me, the fountain of living water, which, by the way, is so intimately related to that dialogue with Jesus at the woman by the well, this living water, this life water. But he says, number two, you've hewn for yourself broken cisterns and that can hold no water. And what you're referring to is that volunteerism, somebody, that involvement in church, being a broken cistern, and yet they are so upset, A, they have not received what they wanted to internally from that service. And then when somebody questions what they've been doing or they lose it, you're right. All of us say, instead of looking at that experience of saying, okay, I'm no longer in this particular role, what is it that is making me so angry? And what is it that's causing me to feel so hurt?
And what's true about me now, you know? And that's the thing. I think God just loves us so much that he may allow, not to say he orchestrates it, so to speak. I mean, there's times I think where decisions are made and they're made in not the most gracious way. But the point is he still on the throne? And what's true about you now, even if you don't have that role attached to your name, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that many people have the vocabulary or the awareness biblically to be able to say, what's true about me now is the same thing that was true about me last week when none of this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that as I am loved immensely, lavishly, sacrificially by a sovereign and gracious God who's given himself up for me. And he goes back to what we were talking about with the Joseph story in Genesis, in the midst of some very awful conditions. It still says, and the Lord was with Joseph.
Yeah.
And so right now in the midst, I mean, you were following a real prompting there, and I want to defer and respect that because I think you're onto it. Someone listening, they're no longer in a particular role of service. And yes, maybe they were doing some stuff that caused the backlash. You know, Joseph did some stuff that caused backlash, but it didn't warrant how he was really treated.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're there, and maybe they're in that prison of disappointment or bitterness to be able to grasp and say, there is, in terms of God's posture towards me, there's nothing different today that's true about me that wasn't last week. And how can I, instead of running from this, learn from it, lean into it,
mm-hmm.
and really steward this broken experience, and and become refined. I think so often we do try to rush out of the desert instead of sit in the hot sand and say, what do I need to harvest from this before God? He's not loving me any less, but maybe I need to experience his love a little bit more by letting him love me here and now.
And the people that I've seen do that, Matt, have emerged better leaders, better servants, more humble, gracious. I just think there's something so, as you say, refining and powerful about it. It's painful. But I'm telling you, there's times because something may be working for us, we've got a formula around it, but it's a false sense of security because what happens if it drops out? Will you be okay? And so I think it's just good to say, ask myself every once in a while, what is so important that if I lose it, I will, you know, fall apart. And so, in fact, you even asked the book in the question, you asked the question in the book, where do I need to be compassionately cut with the scalpel of Jesus? Maybe address that and just why we would need to dare to even ask that question.
Yeah, I think the immediate context where I make that statement in the book is regarding Christ's dialogue with that woman by the well and bringing up this five husbands thing and saying that he was using words like a surgeon would use a scalpel. And that's the background of that. He wasn't condemning her, shaming her, but he was asking he was pointing out something very uncomfortable and doing some surgery. And for me, it's saying, where do I need to be cut with the scalpel of Jesus? Is saying, what is it in my life that I love more than Jesus? Hmm. What is it in my life that I'm trying to extract, from which I'm trying to extract what only Jesus can give me? And it goes from sinful stuff to real laudable stuff. I mean, Jesus, remember when he told the religious leaders, he says, he's rebuking them. And he says, you're searching the scriptures. And you think, okay, that's pretty positive. I'm in four Bible studies. Isn't that a good thing? And this is a rebuke. He says, you search the scriptures, thinking that you're doing the right thing, but it's only from me that you're going to receive life. He's not saying scripture study is bad. He's saying make sure that you're letting your scripture study do for it what it should be doing, and that's leading you to me. And me being able to be quiet long enough to let that scalpel lovingly expose those idols. You know, John Calvin referred to us as idol factories. He says, we'll just make more. You know, one gets exposed, we deal with it. And that's going to be true my whole life because I'm a worshiper. You're a worshiper. We're all worshipers. And whether we're worshiping church service or drug addiction or something in between, those idols need to be exposed. And for me to trust him in the midst of that surgery is an amazing, amazing gift that it takes faith to step into that realm. But it's a beautiful step.
Beautiful step. And when we trust that he is good, we can entrust ourselves to him. I just have probably time for one more question before we pray. Just revisiting this issue of our longings. And I think sometimes we're afraid of our longings. We're afraid of our dreams. And that's why we spiritualize excluding them from our lives. In fact, I've actually heard people say that they felt it was their cross to bear to ignore their longings. And yet you say to ignore them is to numb our experience of what it means to be human. How do we do this? How do we wrap our arms around the wholeness of who we are, that we have desires and longings, we're physical and we're spiritual? How do we do that in God's presence to experience what he has for us?
Well, I think it's embedded in your question, is consciously deal with those in God's presence. I think there are a lot of times that we feel like, okay, if I'm going to grapple with my longings, I've got to go into the closet, as if there's a closet somewhere that God can't get into. And this is where I'm going to pay attention to these. And it's very important to distinguish between, and we can talk about this at another time, the difference between pursuits and longings. I mean, it's important to distinguish between, okay, is this a pursuit that I'm going after in order to achieve or get fulfillment for a longing? That's one. But another is important to realize this longing is, if somebody tells me I've got a longing that's very sinful, I would say, okay, let's unpack that, because I'm not sure if you've gone deep enough. Because those God-shaped longings that are deep within us, what's sinful is that we attach sinful pursuits thinking that that's going to fulfill that longing. Mm. Somebody saying, okay, I have a real longing to rob this bank, and I just can't get over it, or a real longing for extramarital sex, and I just need to go after that. Well, you know what? That's not a longing. That's a pursuit that we think is going to address a deeper longing that has not been met yet in those sinful pursuits, but I'm hoping it will someday, instead of stopping and saying, instead of a new car, a new wife, a new drug, a new position at church, maybe I need to go a little bit deeper and actually believe the gospel and begin to unpack this living water that Jesus was promising to this woman. And it doesn't mean all my longings are going to be immediately satisfied, but I do believe the gospel immediately addresses all of those longings. And I don't know from a time standpoint, but I'll quickly give you a little synopsis. My family was driving along in Wyoming, which there's not a whole lot going on in Wyoming on the interstate. And we all fell asleep. He had a brand new driver's license. All of a sudden, the beeper goes off. We're out of gas. We've got X number of miles. He wakes us up. We all have a longing for gasoline. Our cell signals are all done because we're in the middle of nowhere, so we have no cell signal. We're looking at the possibility of being stranded on the side of the road, and who knows what happens. We finally see a sign that's a credible sign that says, gas this number of miles away. Well, we relaxed. Our longings had not been satisfied, but they had been addressed, because we knew it was coming, and that's part of what the gospel is about.
Oh, Matt, I do pray you'll come back next month, because we've got that and so much more to talk about around your book, and this has been such an honor. Would you wrap up by praying that God would just, as we especially enter this next season of life, that we would discern the difference between our pursuits and our longings so that we can find ourselves in Him in every way?
Absolutely. No, it'd be my privilege. Let's do that right now. Father, I ask that you would enable us to realize that the gospel is actually good news. And instead of just informing us, may we begin to embrace and approach the gospel in a way that it would inspire us. And realizing that you've come, that we might be fully human. May we be honest with you about our longings. But while we're going deep with our longings, may we also go deep with the gospel and not just companion a deep look at our longings with a superficial gospel. And as a result, may we be living men and women, living life in such a way that glorifies you, fulfills us, and is a reflection of you to this world that's watching.
God bless you, Matt. This has been so great. Thank you for the time.
Thank you so much, Susie. Bless you as well, and have a great Thanksgiving. We got a lot to be thankful for.
Indeed. Bill and Pam Farrell are up next.